Welcome to Through Rough Waters, a biblically based mental health podcast presented by WCSG and supported by West Michigan Wellness Group. I'm your host, Zach Allen. Joining me is my co-host, Kevin DeCam. Kevin, how are you?
So good, Zach. I'm so excited to be back for season two.
Joining us today is also Matt Krieg. Matt is a licensed therapist where his focus is on issues relating to marriage and sexuality. Matt works at Second Story Counseling as the Grand Rapids site director. He also co-hosts the Hole in My Heart podcast with his wife, Lori, another great WCSG podcast. Listen if you're not already. Matt is a follower of Jesus who, since 2015, has been able to share how the Lord has brought him out of his own pornography addiction and into a place of love and restoration. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. I'm really excited to be here. Kevin, it's great meeting you.
Finally.
And I am ready to have a conversation. It's really good to be in a familiar place and to talk about something that's very necessary. So,
and not have the cameras on.
No cameras. It's very different.
Audio only for this great one. So Matt is joining us not only as a therapist, but as someone to share his own personal story. As we launch season two of Through Rough Waters, we're starting with a series on addiction. In this episode, we're going to spend some time looking at the science and the brain chemistry behind what makes something addictive and talk about some of the ways that people can slip into addiction without even knowing it and some steps that you can take to begin your journey to recovery. As always, we like to start by looking at some scripture. Addictions are as old as sin itself. Sometimes I think as believers especially, we can be tempted to think addiction is something new and modern, and there's certainly things around today like the internet that weren't around when the Bible was written, but the Bible still has lots of wisdom for us about addictions. One of the things that we're going to talk about in this discussion is how easy it is for someone, even someone who is a firm believer in Jesus, to fall into this temptation of addiction. One of the most sneaky things about it is thinking that you're not going to get addicted, thinking you've got your self-control, your willpower is going to be strong enough. And the Bible's got some stuff to say about that. We're going to look at two verses today, one Old Testament, one New. The first one, a rhetorical question. Love it when the Bible asks us a rhetorical question. This is Proverbs 6:27. Can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes and not be burned? I think we know the answer to that one. But in 1 Corinthians 6:12, there's a really famous verse. I'm doing it from the Message paraphrase here because I often like that it gives us just a slightly different perspective. It says, just because something is technically legal doesn't mean that it's spiritually appropriate. If I went around doing whatever I thought I could get by with, I would be a slave to my whims. So we got some smart guys in the room here using that wisdom from scripture. What are some tools that we can use to not get burned? And how can someone know the difference between what is technically legal and spiritually appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, I love that 1 Corinthians verse. I often will couple it with the first chapter of the book of James, when James is talking about this progression from temptation. Like when we are tempted, it says, don't let us say God is tempting us. It's instead by our own evil desires, which that evil desire, if you look at the Greek, it's epithumia. It can actually mean passionate desire, overt desire. It's not that the thing itself is this inherently evil thing. But that kind of murky, ethereal desire that we hold, it's like temptation is when that desire becomes magnetized to something. And then once that temptation really gets rooted, that's when it draws us into sin. And I use that 1 Corinthians verse because that, you know, the, I think it's NIV would say everything is permissible, not everything is beneficial. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to look at the things that draw people to their addictions. And some spaces there are things that are beneficial. And it can quickly turn into something that's no longer beneficial, but it is permitted.
Like my addiction has been food for most of my life. You got to eat. You got to eat to survive. That is a very beneficial thing. But
absolutely, yeah. And yet, at some point, if you don't have these way markers along kind of that slippery downturned slope, like muddy slope, to keep you from taking that from a beneficial place to a permissible, and then I use the terms detrimental and then harmful, especially if it's not a Christian person that I'm talking to, because it's not going to have that like biblical overtone to it. You know, but there's this progression of benefit, something that was once beneficial becomes less and less so, and then it can enter into these harmful spaces. And so, you know, I love it because addiction doesn't start as an addiction. Mm-hmm. It starts as a choice. And then it's when you find yourself in this place of, I can no longer say no to it. that we start to realize, like, okay, there's something more than just habit going on here.
Yeah, and to play off of that too, Matt and Zach, I would say that to emphasize that idea that the problem is not the object, or sometimes even the behavior, at least mm-hmm. at the beginning of what we're talking about, it's really the posture of our heart towards that thing. So when we limit ourselves by looking at something like an addiction from a purely legalistic standpoint, we get caught up in a little too much emphasis on the good and bad, the right and wrong piece of it. And certainly those elements exist, but I think it really limits the way that we look at this. And especially as we'll get into here, how do we emerge out of a place where this behavior or my heart's desire for this thing has become problematic and even harmful? The way we walk through that and the way we move from that is also to look at our plan versus God's plan, right? So Zach, I'll play off of food, as you said, mm-hmm. not only not bad, I would say very good, and at the very least, like you said, necessary. And yet what is God's plan for food in my life? Am I following that? Am I using it for my nourishment and even my enjoyment at time? Or has the posture of my heart shifted to where it has become something I seek in an idolatrous way? Has it taken the place that is protected for God within my heart?
I used to have a pastor always say, when we take a good thing and make it an ultimate thing, ultimately that good thing becomes the most destructive thing.
There you go.
So Matt, I've heard you talk in the past. You've got a really great analogy about what we're talking about here, about an octopus and an ink cloud. If you want to share that with us, I love that picture.
Yeah. So I often look at these evil desires, these passionate desires, these overt desires, as kind of this moment when an octopus releases an ink cloud. You know, and it's a self-protective measure, but like you can see the ink cloud. It's this murky, ethereal thing. It's like, I know there is an octopus in there, but you can't often tell where the octopus is until the tentacle like reaches out and you see it trying to pull itself toward a crevice in the rocks mm-hmm. or in the reef. And so oftentimes the first kind of conscious thought that people will have about a temptation is when it's already kind of latched onto something. I really want that brownie, or I really want that image that I find on my computer. I really want that drink or whatever it is. There's this tangibleness that comes when that desire is being placed on an object. And so if rather than going down that path of saying, I see the object, I'm pursuing the object, if we can say, what is going on here? And what is that object promising me? Speaking to that desire of the heart, we can start to work our way backward to say, okay, what is this passionate, overt, idolatrous, possibly desire that I feel? And is there a way that desire can actually be good if I can take my own pride, if I can take my own self-sufficiency out of the equation and kind of disentangle that evil desire back into its proper place? What is that? Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about freedom from addiction, freedom from habits, the ability to recognize, okay, what am I really going to this object for becomes vitally necessary. And we'll get into it more with my story, I think, but like I work with a lot of guys who deal with pornography issues. And sometimes that pornography can be kind of driven by the emotion of stress. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be driven by loneliness or boredom. Those are the three top ones that I hear. Well, if you're stressed, going and walking by yourself through a wooded path can be really restorative. If you're lonely, going and walking by yourself through a wooded path can be really isolating. Yeah. And so there isn't like this one size fits all response to that desire. You have to become aware of what that emotional driver is in order to know how to appropriately respond to it.
Yeah. I love the idea that you start to introduce here, and I know we'll develop this further, of identifying the need. Same in my practice and in my work with folks and in my work in my own life. Again, from a legalistic standpoint, if we limit ourselves by looking at this as I did a thing and the thing was bad, then the natural next step is then stop that thing. And eventually, that's an important part of the equation, right? But the first, we have to have the courage and the willingness and the mindfulness and or the assistance of somebody who can see it more clearly than we can from our own seat. There's our early plug for the value of counseling in this process. For someone to see, well, hang on a minute, why am I doing the thing that I'm doing, right? Mm-hmm. What purpose is that serving? What need is that fulfilling? And often what we find, I think you were getting at this, it is a pure need, right? Mm-hmm. It's either a need that I have and or a corresponding problem I'm having around mm-hmm. that. Take loneliness, right? Yeah. We need community. We need belonging. We need relationship. We are literally designed and created for it. That need is imprinted upon our heart. So when that need is not being fulfilled, it will create a problem and the associated feelings like mm-hmm. loneliness. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. That's very important to take a look at. It's just, of course, when we become misdirected in how it is that we're attempting to fulfill that need, that we find ourselves in trouble. And yeah. and I agree, you teed this up a little bit too, Matt. Nobody sets out, this is a little crude, but I will often say, if we take drinking as one form of addiction, in preschool, when the teacher asked the kids to draw a picture of what they wanted to be when they grew up, no kid drew a picture of an alcoholic, right? Yeah. I mean, that no one said, my game plan here is to become addicted. How do I get there, mm-hmm. right? It starts with a need, and often that need is pure. That need is important. That need is a part of what it means for us to live as God's children. And then our seeking to fulfill it is what has gotten us misdirected and in trouble.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking about how easy it is to get addicted, before we get into some more practical stuff, I want to get us all on the same page and talk about what addiction actually is. It's not just some feeling. It's not just some thoughts. There's something physically happening in someone's brain when they get addicted. So the word that we often use, and we talk about that, a big science word everyone's probably familiar with, though, dopamine. What is it, guys?
I might have been late to this game, but it took me a long time to know that when people refer to drugs as dope, that what they were meaning was dopamine.
Not a bad thing. Dopamine is a part of our body. It's God a part of our brain.
Yeah. God created it. We need it. It's actually not only helpful, sometimes enjoyable, sometimes absolutely necessary for us to function in the way that we're designed to be functioned. But like any good thing, it's very easily misused. I went to a speaker once when I was hosting men's conferences. A speaker came in and said something to the effect. His claim was that if we could figure out as humans how to perfectly synthesize dopamine, we'd all be dead. And his point was, if we could find a way to inject dopamine into our body, it would be so alluring and so highly addictive to add that to our makeup and to our experience that we would all seek it and we would all use it till it killed us. That's his claim. I'll let him stick with it, but it's compelling and it has stuck with me often just in terms of thinking of the power of how compelling dopamine can be. And you know, the trick with this one is it's already in our body, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are healthy and unhealthy ways that we seek to release this drug within our body because it feels really good when we do.
Yeah. So what is the connection between dopamine and the things that get us addicted? Like I'll use pornography since that's part of your story, Matt. How does looking at an image eventually result in dopamine shooting out in our brains? Like, what's the connection there?
Yeah. So, I mean, the pornography is a weird one because it is this like hijacking of the brain's natural responses to things like sexual intimacy, which if you are if you're having sex with someone and you're kind of reaching climax, like there is a lot hormonally going mm-hmm. on in the brain. There is dopamine, there's oxytocin, which is that bonding chemical to create like a relational stability.
Which is this beautiful thing that God designed us for.
Yeah, there's norepinephrine and serotonin and adrenaline and all of this stuff that's just going off, this flood within the brain. And dopamine is that high mm-hmm. piece of it. It's part of it that releases that like high, that calm, that serene. And
the buzzy one.
Yeah. And so like when you take something like pornography and you see this in other kind of drug use too, if you show someone a picture of, you know, heroin and they're a heroin addict, their brain will start lighting up in anticipation of that hit. And so what happens with pornography is you're getting that same response that we are bringing our anticipated experience into that, but it's also something that it's called like a super stimulus. It actually goes beyond what you would normally experience because it can happen in isolation and secrecy and shame and all these things that compound. Mm-hmm. And it just gives you this very extreme high, but then once that wears off, you get the very extreme kind of shame and isolation response.
Almost instantaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what happens, your brain gets used to a certain level of dopamine. And then there's it's habituation and I forget the second term, escalation, where it's like you get used to that level of exposure and then you need the next higher level. And so for pornography, that means people will start with kind of run of the mill, vanilla, quote unquote, types. And then they'll move to one of two directions, typically either harder, kind of more taboo subjects or younger, or more violent. And that is kind of that habituation and escalation response that you see when it comes to pornography. But it's all because your brain is becoming habituated and kind of desensitized to some of the stuff that you've already seen in the past.
We seek novelty, right? And this is true in many addictive circumstances, but it's really easy to see here. So any form of novelty, whatever.
Something.
And, you know, this too, even in that we can see God's original design for what that was supposed to be like, right? Mm-hmm. There's intended to be curiosity and creativity within the relationship as he designed it to be. It fosters healthy relationship. It strengthens relationship. It deepens intimacy between two people who only share certain things with one another. Mm-hmm. And yet when we screw it up and twist it into something of our own making, then the novelty becomes something like that. I either seek that which is more foreign or, as you said, more taboo, more off limits. And one version of that would be younger, younger
people. More violent.
Yeah. Heard that testimony as well from someone talking about his journey. And someone who speaks very openly on this. And he said one of the things that really turned him around in his case, thank goodness, was not that he turned this corner, but he started to see around the next corner within the progression of a sexual addiction and realized that the next thing that was likely to come would be younger material. And it scared him enough to get his attention.
Yeah.
And he was pretty deep. I mean, he was deep enough. He was more than deep enough to have experienced plenty of destruction. But that is always, it's always a progression. Mm-hmm. It must be, because that's part of the original design. And when it becomes obscured, the obscurity also applies, right?
Yeah. And thankfully that progression can go both ways, right? You can either become deepening in your addiction, or because of that, the word we're going to use, neuroplasticity, because our brain is constantly changing, we also can hope for freedom that at some point, we don't have to just remain in that addictive state.
Yeah. Perfect segue, Matt. It's like you're a professional podcaster or something. We are going to talk about, we've talked about that before on Through Rough Waters here, about neuroplasticity and how our brains are constantly changing. But on the topic of addictions, can you guys maybe explain why it is so hard to get unaddicted when you're addicted to something? Like, it's not something that you can just say, well, stop it. Like that old Bob Newhart Saturday Night Live, just stop it. Like, we can't do that. And that's because of neuroplasticity. Like, what's going on in our brains that makes it so hard for us to get unaddicted?
Well, the first thing I would double down on just quickly is what it is that we're talking about. Because there is a progressive element to how this works, even within the dopamine cycle, pretty much any other drug, in order to maintain the same level of high, I must increasingly use more over time. And that's true of dopamine as well, because my neurons become desensitized to the levels at which I'm used to, right? This is what you're talking about, Matt. And eventually, when there's a significant progression, right? Again, God designed our brains to utilize dopamine and to fire on and respond to dopamine, but not at the levels that we max them out to, right? When we kind of redline this all the way to a point it wasn't designed to handle. It's like literally running a car at too many RPMs. Eventually the motor burns out, right? And eventually our neurons sort of burn out, right? They wear down. They don't respond as intensely or as quickly to the same level of chemical input. And so we need more and more and more, or we need different and more different. And so part of why it gets more difficult is because it just pulls us, you know, that's that pull, that draw of addiction, that it just pulls us deeper and deeper and further down. And it gets hard to back away from that, because by now the habitual pieces, we've developed the need. And I'll tee this up. Maybe we'll come back around to this later, but part of it too, when I'm working with clients is, you mentioned, boredom, Matt. But also stress, when we utilize something like addiction, even sexual addiction, as a way of managing our stress, We have forfeited the opportunity to learn other ways to manage stress in the meantime and become more and more and more dependent, not just on pornography, not just on the behavior or on the dopamine, but on that as our one coping mechanism, right? Everything. I only have a hammer, so everything looks like a nail, right? And when nails continue to surround themselves, surround me in my life, when stress continues to come up, I still need a way to deal with it. And that's the opportunity loss. That's a big part of recovery too, that I'm sure we'll talk about. And part of what makes it really difficult is it's the thing I do to manage my life by now. It's not just what I do for fun. It's not just a thing I do to feel good. It's literally how I manage stress and boredom and other things in my life. And so part of the work, again, I'm sure we'll come back around to, is how do we replace that? How do we build the toolbox?
Yeah. Well, and the difficulty with that is, in order to replace it, in order to learn, you have to be willing to become very uncomfortable and to deal with those negative emotions, the stress, the loneliness, the isolation, whatever it is that that emotion is, we have to learn to sit in it. And none of us like to. I don't care what you run to. Like, none of us like to feel sad or lonely or ridiculed or embarrassed or anything like that. We will consciously and actively avoid these emotions at all costs.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so to become unaddicted, you have to step into those spaces.
Yeah. Because in addiction, that's why I did it in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. We don't look at that piece, right? I enjoyed the drink, or I enjoyed the image, and that's all obvious. And that's what eventually drew me in. But what I didn't realize was happening in the meantime is I was avoiding the feeling of my own uncomfortable feelings and my capacity to sit with those, because that's part of life.
Mm-hmm. So now we kind of have our little dopamine 101. Everyone's kind of on the same page. This is what's happening in your brain. So Matt, I want to dig into your story a little bit here, your personal story, and also your story just as a therapist walking through hundreds of people on this same story. What are some questions that you can ask yourself, or behaviors that you can see in yourself to realize, uh-oh, I think I might be addicted? Like, how did you know you had a problem?
Well, the funny thing is, I was adamant that I was not addicted until I was about 6 months sober. And for me, I was always like in that mindset of, well, if I really wanted to stop it, I could, or, you know, that sort of thing, like seeing it as a habit, but not an addiction. But when I look back, I mean, it was a daily occurrence. It was something that, because of my bonding to pornography, I was avoidant of sexual intimacy with my wife. Like, it was having a drastic effect on my relationship with Lori. It was having a drastic effect on my work performance. I actually got fired not because of the pornography, but because my performance at work suffered so bad that they were like, hey, we are not going to renew your contract, as I was actively working as a missionary to at-risk youth in California. And so there were some extreme consequences to that. And as I said, I was a missionary. I was not unchristian. This was something that I have carried with me since I was 11 years old, and didn't know how to break free, and fought tooth and nail however I could to try and just stop, to quote Bob Newhart, to try and just white knuckle it and make it on my own without ever paying attention to the emotional pieces that were involved.
Matt, can I ask you to break down, to back up just a little bit, for the person listening who might find themselves in the same shoes? Yeah, okay, there's this behavior, and yeah, maybe it's gone a little further than I want it to, but I'm not looking at it as addiction. When you talked about the firing piece, right? It wasn't that you got in trouble, that you got caught, that something happened. Help people who are trying to make sense of what you mean by that your being addicted was making it all the way to showing up in work performance, because it's not a A to B direct line, right?
Well, it's so much energy was being spent on both maintaining my ability to connect with my addiction of pornography, but also maintaining that secrecy of not getting caught, that I was putting a lot of emotional and mental energy into, like, how and when I managed that. But it also is something that the more I did it, and it's a cycle, like, I would go to pornography, and then I would, 5 minutes later, after I was done, like, I would feel that shame and feel that guilt, and then isolate and feel worthless. And that worthlessness would then be the thing that I needed to go and get that dopamine hit. And so it just kind of cycled and cycled and deepened.
And in the meantime, you're feeling worthless and low on energy, right? So you might have at that point in your story been paying attention to the 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, sure. This is costing me 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But what you didn't realize till much later in your recovery was, no, this is costing me all day, every day.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, I think, really helpful.
And when I say 5 minutes, I'm meaning like I didn't just look at pornography for 5 minutes. Like sometimes it was hours long.
Right.
Binge session type things. Like
okay.
This wasn't a 5 minute little hobby thing, but like 5 minutes after I was done looking,
okay.
that high was gone and I was despondent and I was depressed and felt very worthless.
And that's the piece that I think is helpful for people to hear. Okay. So even if it's a couple of hours, mm-hmm. you likely viewing it the way you said you were viewing it, were not probably counting the cost of that despondency, of that shame, of that feeling tired, mm-hmm. of that inability. You mentioned this too, the inability to do hard things, the inability to sit with discomfort and manage things. If you could have been looking at it more closely then, as you could now, you would see that this was filtering into all areas of your life.
Oh yeah.
And I just think that's really important. I pardon the interruption, but I think that's helpful for the person listening and trying to evaluate where they are, because they would be making the same mistake you were.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other piece, as I came clean, and that is a whole story in itself, but as I got more distance from the pornography piece, I realized, like, in order to save my marriage, I asked Lori, hey, what is something that I can do to prove to you that I want to be with you more than I want to hold on to this addiction? And she said immediately, get rid of everything. No phone, no computer, no tablet, no anything, no access, which for me was highly important. Because A, it showed her that I was serious, and B, I wasn't an alcoholic trying to become sober in a bar. Mm. To limit my access was very necessary. And what I learned was pornography wasn't my only addiction. I was screen addicted. I was constantly like 3 screens on in front of me at all times. There would be a sporting event on TV. I would be playing a game on my phone. I'd be looking at stats on my computer. And that was the like, quote unquote, benign stuff, the permissible stuff that was like allowed.
Co-occurring
is
this whole other level.
But I was doing anything and everything I could to live outside of my own emotion. And so I was always, escapism, 100%. Doing everything I could to live outside of my own life and outside of my own brain.
So could you land the plane? I'm jumping in, Zach. You're sorry. I'm this is fun for me.
You're the professionals, guys. I'm just the radio guy over here.
No, I haven't had a chance, Matt. Actually, as you said earlier, we haven't met yet, and I've known who you are, but we haven't had a chance to talk. And I appreciate your openness to be able to jump right in and use your story, but then we can break it apart for people to be able to learn from, which is great. I just appreciate what you were talking about there as well, the layers of addictiveness. And when we talked about what is the need being served by what morphs into an addiction, mm-hmm. could you help identify that for people who are trying to figure your story out and compare it to their own?
Yeah.
What you talked about like masking emotions maybe, but mm-hmm. what needs were you pursuing? What problems were you solving by all those layers of addiction?
Yeah. So primarily I think the thing that I wrestle with the most, and we talk about it on our podcast, Hole in My Heart podcast, as core needs. These are God created longings that are supposed to be some of the things that drive us into relationship with Him. And the place, because of some of my life experience, the place that I feel most depleted is this thought of like, I am chosen, I am sought, I'm desired. And so for me, a question that I've constantly had over my head since young childhood was, am I worth anything? And so to feel chosen in those moments by an actress on a screen who doesn't know I exist is one way where for moments at a time I could feel like someone desires me. I would also do that by trying to perform well at school or perform well at sports. And sometimes, I mean, we're made for this bonding with something, right? Mm-hmm. Like we see it with football. Mm-hmm. I mean, here we are in Michigan. Lions fans love other Lions fans, but if you say you're a Packers fan, you're going to have an immediate response of like, that is the out group. I'm aggressive toward that.
Right.
So we're made for some of this bonding, and I bonded to my own sports teams. I grew up in Dallas. Well, I was born in Dallas, So all of their sports teams I kept. I lost the accent. But like Cowboys games was like a bonding moment for me and my family.
I'm experiencing the thing though. Yeah, that you were
there's
just
a reason
about.
I've waited so long to tell you this, but that was a way that my family spent time and bonded together. And so for me, going and watching a Cowboys game, or even just being by myself and watching a Cowboys game, can have the benefit of kind of this family rite of passage. Now, if that goes to then watching whatever game comes on next, I'll say the Cleveland Browns. I don't care about the Browns. I have no affinity for them whatsoever. But if I'm just sitting there and remaining on this trajectory of my life is coming through sports and I'm living vicariously through whatever's there, okay, what was once beneficial is now it's like, okay, it's not bad, but it's also like, what are you doing? It's worthless. This aimless wandering. And then if at some point during that Browns game, I'm not even watching the game, but I'm scanning the sidelines for cheerleaders. Okay, I'm already entering a place where my mind is becoming sexualized and I'm looking for that hit. And it's a very quick jump from that to jumping on YouTube or whatever modality of finding those more explicit erotic images or videos are. And so for me, as I came clean, I had to know where I was on that trajectory. It's okay to watch a Cowboys game. I also don't want to live watching Cowboys games because as much as I love the Cowboys, they don't know I exist. They're not real. And so I was at one point a 30-hour-a-week sports content consumer. Now I limit myself to being able to sit down and watch one sporting event a week. Now I'll still check sports scores and whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't want to let that become misordered and lead me back into this escapist consumptive mindset, which takes me down that path to pornography. I want to be present in my own life, not just physically there and emotionally absent.
So to distill the couple core needs mm-hmm. there, one is to belong, to connect, to be a part of something.
Yes.
The other is to be valued or cherished for who mm-hmm. you are. And we can see when we name it that way, how important they are, how central they are.
Yeah, they're good things.
They're good things. God wrote them into the design for our lives. And as you said, to highlight, uses them to draw us closer to where we're supposed to be, which is mm-hmm. in right relationship with him.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nothing wrong with having those needs. There's nothing wrong with even expressing those needs by watching a game with family, because that's a healthy way of exercising.
Yeah.
Where this really gets out of its lane is when it pulls you further in. Mm-hmm. And that's what I hear you describing. It takes a while until you realize you're that far off course. Not to mention, in the case of your story, as is often the case, they start to overlap, right? This need around sexuality actually intersects with this need around bonding. Mm-hmm. And maybe boredom plays a part of that, right?
Yeah.
Just the general stimulus of watching something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I appreciate that, because I think that's the thing that's really hard to be able to identify that early in your story, which you can now see clearly, but couldn't have then.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a good example of you didn't set out on that course, mm-hmm. right? You got pulled into that direction. Appreciate yeah. that.
Before we move on from this kind of identifying addictive behaviors, I want to put myself in the shoes of maybe someone who's listening to this episode. They've never experienced an addiction themselves, but someone they love has. I know it's not fair because Lori's not here, Matt, but she was a big part of your story of identifying what was going on. What were some of the things that Lori noticed in you to realize that you needed help? And what are some things that we can look for maybe in someone that we love's life? Like, hey, I think something might be going on here. Like, you might be addicted to something.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is Lori didn't know about my pornography addiction until I told her. So this was something that she didn't catch me in, but she could see I was depressed. And she would speak to that. We had friends that actually got me like free sessions with a kind of a therapist, a more spiritual director type of person out in California, that at the time when they gave them to me, I was like, what's this going to do? I don't need this. And then like 2 days later is when my boss had the conversation with me, letting me know I was fired. So all of a sudden there was something to talk about. But Lori didn't know. But the thing that she did inadvertently that it simultaneously brought me great pain, but then also like was very sobering, was she would constantly talk to other people about me and say, Matt is the most integrity, like laden, honest and upfront guy. And every time she said that, it's like there was a knife twisting in me because I longed to be that and I knew that I wasn't. I also heard her talking, like she's been open with her own story. And there's a kind of that sexual component to her story mm-hmm. as well. And so hearing her talk about her story also gave me hope that she might be able to understand some of mine. And so if someone is listening to this and they know someone who maybe is struggling with some level of addiction, whether it's sexual, whether it's a substance use, a, you know, behavioral addiction, whatever, it's not, the great thing is it's not about kind of building that immediate bridge of, ooh, I've had that too. If you start talking heart level, that need to be chosen mm-hmm. or sought or affirmed or belong, like, I don't care what you run to, we've all needed that at some point. And so even if you're not able to touch the addiction, if you can start raising people's awareness of those good longings that they have that aren't evil, that aren't deficiencies in themselves, but like truly these God-ordained things that we carry with us, that could help them start to see like, okay, maybe there is another way. Maybe I truly do need that good thing. And maybe I'm willing to seek that in ways that don't include my addiction.
And so again, in doing so, we're putting the focus where it belongs on the original need instead mm-hmm. of over-focusing as we tend to on the behavior.
Yeah.
This is why we all laugh at the new heart skit, because we know it's funny to think, A, that if I hadn't thought of just stopping it, I would need to pay somebody to do so, right? And that it were just as simple as that, that it's not just about the behavior, right? Everyone watching that skit, if you haven't seen it, look it up.
We'll put it in the show notes. You've got
to see it. Oh, yes, yes. I've literally played it in session before. It's worth a watch anyway. But right, everyone is wondering as they're watching it, what is it with this thing? Why is it that the person is struggling with this thing when the therapist who's supposed to be helping is only saying, knock it off, mm-hmm. right? And so, yeah, you're identifying that original need and addressing it. And therefore, you have the opportunity to displace with hope what otherwise so easily gets filled in with shame.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. There's focused more on what is the good thing you can say yes to rather than the bad thing that we're trying to say no to.
There you go.
You know, and that lets you become, and I don't know if you've read the accountability kind of conversation. Okay. What is accountability? Is it the police officer who is, you know, making sure you don't mess up, or is it the coach who's helping you figure out how to do better? Is it the cardiologist who's like, hey, let's take a look at your heart and see how you're ticking, mm-hmm. you know, and to be that non-judgmental, non-critical person who's hopefully inviting this person into true thriving is going to do something, not just for hopefully this person, but also in your relationship, that you don't have to bear the weight or the responsibility of just policing and managing their behavior.
So we've already talked a little bit about this back at the beginning when we were talking about 1 Corinthians and James. We've talked about the things that can kind of trigger these addictive behaviors, like stress is one, loneliness is one. Matt, you've shared like what your personal triggers were in your story. What are some other examples of things that we might not realize are like the first step into the danger zone that we can try to be aware of in our lives? And when we've kind of identified these triggers, what are some steps we can do to respond to those triggers in a healthy way rather than in the unhealthy way?
I mean, anything can become a trigger, honestly. Like you do something enough and that can become the only way that you learn to, as you talked about earlier, manage your stresses mm-hmm. and your pains and your emotions. You know, and I talked about like football for me. That's not in itself this addiction, but I spent so much time there that was something that I became addicted to. And so, yeah, I don't know if you have like a specific trigger you're thinking of when you ask the question.
No, more I want to get the point across that no one is immune from the idea of that we can be addicted. Like, a trigger is not, I've got a horrible home life and I'm sad all the time. Like, yes, you're very conducive to fall into addictive behaviors from that, but no one is immune to this. Like, anything can send someone on this path if we're not being aware of ourselves.
Yeah. And in fact, just to amplify that part of your point, I don't know if you would agree with this statement, Matt, you've probably heard a version of it, but the idea that really we're all addicts. And I think that's actually an important place to start, because again, we can get into this legalism. I haven't crossed that line, but you have, or it's not that bad for me. And that's really dangerous, right? We do this with alcohol all the time. When we think of an alcoholic, we picture a man laying in the gutter with a brown bag in his hand, mm-hmm. right? But that's not actually what alcoholism looks like most of the time, that mm-hmm. it's true. And so it's important to start with this idea. There's obviously a distinction, and I'll get back around to maybe my thought on the answer to that question. But starting by saying, we all have at least the propensity for addiction, because as human beings, we all have this little meat computer between our ears that is largely based on comfort and stress alleviation and the alleviation of fear and other things versus pleasure, right? And that makes us all prone to function in these ways. And so I think, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, Zach, but part of the idea of like a trigger or a measuring line sort of where has this become a problem is, am I functioning in a way that's disruptive to my baseline, normal, healthy way of functioning? Or within my personality, I heard this in your account of the story, am I functioning, am I showing up in my daily life in the way that's sort of native to me or reflective of the clearest understanding I have of who God created me to be, right? So you talked about like depression, right? But people, no one noticed but you that there was this behavior going on, but people around you could notice that you were depressed, mm-hmm. right? Nobody knew why. You maybe did or didn't at that point, but now you can look back and draw a line between those things, right? When I'm living in shame, of course I'm depressed, mm-hmm. right? And I know, only I know at this point why I'm living in shame, right? So sometimes it's those kind of things. And this too is where community is important, and or the objectivity of a helping professional who is looking from the outside in to say, well, there are things that are doing that are either not healthy or are disruptive to a healthy pattern of functioning, or are just not native to who I know you to be, right? And sometimes that's our first clue that something's getting triggered, that something's going on. There's something stinky in the woodshed, as my other friend says.
Well, speaking of that professional help, I'm going to ask you guys to put on your therapist hats now here. When does someone know it's time to seek that professional help? Like, what are you looking for inside yourself to know, yeah, I can't just stop it. I need help. Like, what would you say to someone to get them to seek that help, the deep need for a professional to help you, because you can't do it by yourself?
I think the first thing I would say, and this is not just like pandering, is you are not somehow worse off than everyone else if you're seeking help from a professional. Like, let's like remove some of the stigma from counseling. Sometimes, well, actually, I would say in all times, it's good to have insight from someone else outside of yourself. And so like, if you don't think you're addicted, you could probably benefit from counseling. If you are addicted, you could probably benefit from counseling. If there's a problem going on in your life and you just don't have any place that you can comfortably talk about it, you could benefit from counseling. And so let's not, I don't think it's good to say like, okay, what is the line when you absolutely need that professional help? We all need help. Mm-hmm. You know, and to just say like, hey, if you are even interested in exploring your story, consider it.
Yeah. The difference between people who seek counseling and people who don't is not people who have problems and people who don't. It's people who are willing to talk about the problems they have, because we all have them. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And that might sound really obvious when you put it together like that. And I think we're getting much better at looking at it this way, but it wasn't long ago and still is the case sometimes that we look at that distinction as, oh, the people who are in counseling are the ones with a problem. And mm-hmm. so what I hear in your answer is, yeah, we've all got them. And especially if I don't have a place I can go to talk about that and know that I will have somebody committed to giving me feedback in care, mm-hmm. objectively, without criticism, without judgment, with the intent of and desire for me to be at my best, then that's a place that I could find that. Sometimes a friend can do that. Sometimes a spouse can do that. Although the warning there is they're almost never as objective. Right?
Oh,
the least objective person in the world when it comes to me, and second is my wife.
Yeah.
But she's a lot more objective than I am about myself. So that's helpful, right? And my good friends or accountability partners can be next. And then way down the road is this counseling thing where, way down the road is strangers. They don't really care. Counselors, we stay far enough away with our boundaries to remain objective, but we get close enough to care. And to unpack the story, I like that you led with that too. Just someone listen to my story with an objective ear and see what they hear. If someone had done that prior to everything kind of hitting the fan for you, Matt, they, with the right ear, they may have been able to hear things and kind of draw you into connecting some dots.
They would have shown me how to ask questions, like the right questions, not just the, how can I stop doing this? But like, what is this giving you? What is this promising you? Like, what do you want of this? What do you desire? What do you need?
So before we wrap up, we want to spend some time with our listeners. It's time for Q&A. If you've got a question that you'd like us to answer, a couple ways you can submit it. You can head to wcsg.org, search for podcasts, click on Through Rough Waters, or you can also email your question throughroughwaters@wcsg.org. We've talked a lot about this, but we're just going to put it really on the nose here. Today's question is anonymous. She says, someone I love destroying their life with bad habits. I'm watching them get angry and defensive, isolating themselves, and I'm really scared for them. When I try to bring it up, I get immediately shot down and told there's no problem. I'm imagining things. I'm making it up. How can I help this friend understand that they need help?
I mean, the funny thing is that person sounds a lot like me. Not the person who wrote this question, but the person they're describing. You know, and so I would say keep asking them about their heart. Keep encouraging them, not just with, hey, you need to stop this thing, but with the good you see in them, and calling them into a place of recognizing, you know, that even though they maybe are engaging in these bad behaviors, these unhelpful behaviors, that they are still image bearers, that they are still someone who is created in the image of God and has dignity and value based on that and that alone.
Yeah. I love it. I'll take two risks here. One is to sound cliche, like it's the Gold Star Sunday School answer. But I think of prayer when I think of where the person submitting this question is. They identify a problem. They took the risk of attempting to talk to the person about it. And the person, I would say, based on their answer, doesn't seem to be ready to hear it, ready to deal with it, ready to go anywhere. That can be really frustrating. That can be even scary, especially if you see someone going off a cliff. But the person asking this question and observing this is in a beautiful position to start praying, and praying for. What I would recommend specifically is praying for God to open a door, praying for God to create an opportunity, praying that God illuminates in His timing and His way an opportunity for this person to discover freedom and start to put pieces together. And that might be through this friend because they're very observant. Might not be, might be now, might not be, might be later. This is where we have to trust God and His timing and His script on these things. But that's a wonderful opportunity. And also to begin, I would sort of merge it with the other piece, which is making the risk of sounding redundant and kind of highlighting this. But I just think you're so spot on, Matt, when you talk about the emphasis on the need. Right. I was thinking when you were talking about earlier about one of by far my favorite passages from scripture, which is Jesus with the woman at the well, right? Which is her sin is so obvious. Everyone knows it. Everyone knows it. We know that from even a loose cultural understanding of what was happening at that time where she showed up midday and he was there, that her sin was very obvious and he could have focused on it. He could have talked about it. He could have preached at her. He could have given her a how-to and a self-help on what to do instead. Instead, he met her with grace. He spoke absolute truth. And then what he said to her was, I am the living water, right? He was naming it. He was Jesus after all, a little head start on us on being able to understand what it was that she needed. But he knew, of course, even in his human form, what it was that she needed. And he was talking about it, right? There's the living water that you're seeking and you'll find it in me. And if only you knew that, you'd never thirst again. And I hear you talking about that, Matt. If someone is close enough and discerning enough to be able to understand what a friend like this is in need of or lacking, the merging is we could also pray for that. And then I think the living that out, the embodiment of that is to start to offer it. And maybe that shakes something loose, right? And maybe it's an early part of the healing process to give them the dignity they need, the hope they need, the love they need, the acknowledgement that they need.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would jump on that and also realize like there are those times when there's the obvious behavior that's an issue. But I would be hard pressed to find someone that can't look at the phone in their pocket and say, I'm somehow addicted to it. We all have something we run to. And so as you're trying to look for ways to help others with theirs, make sure you're also turning that attention to your own heart and your own places where maybe you can have a more intimate understanding of some of the things that may drive people to do these things that they don't want to do, yet they find themselves unable to stop.
Thanks so much for joining us on this first episode of our new season of Through Rough Waters. In 2 weeks, we'll be back continuing this talk on addictions, where we take a deep dive on substance abuse. I want to say a big thank you to Matt Krieg for joining us today, for sharing your story, for sharing your expertise. If you're listening to this and you're like, boy, that voice sounds familiar, well, Matt Krieg also hosts Hole in My Heart podcast with his wife, Lori, and Steve from here on WCSG. Matt, if someone's listening to us right now, they haven't checked out Hole in My Heart yet, why don't you tell us what the heart behind Hole in My Heart is and why they should check out your conversations?
So the Hole in My Heart podcast, we strive to connect everyone with the fact that the gospel is good news for everyone every day. And that we all have this hole in our hearts that have a need for God. So it's very much this conversation that we've been having here, and we've been blessed to talk with some amazing people about some amazing things. There's 220 episodes now after 5 years. And so there's plenty of stuff to get caught up on, but the Lord has blessed it. And it's been great to interact with a lot of people about a lot of different things. But yeah.
In the same place that you got this podcast, you can also get the Hole in My Heart podcast, and we'll link it in the show notes too. I want to also thank West Michigan Wellness Group, Kevin, for you and your team for supporting this podcast. If someone's listening and they feel like they need to reach out and have that therapy conversation, how do they get in touch with you guys and how do they start that journey?
Yes, we would love to hear from you. Love to have these conversations. You can go straight to our website at westmichiganwellnessgroup.com. You can give us a call at 616-600-1187 or email info@westmichiganwellnessgroup.com.
Matt, would you wrap us up in prayer?
Yeah. So dear Lord, we just thank you for the time and the sustaining grace that you give all of us, no matter where we are in our journey, that whether we're doing well or whether we're doing poorly and just running after things that so easily catch our eyes, God, that you have always been with us and you always will be. And so, Lord, we just ask for you to open up our hearts and our minds to your voice in our lives. And your voice is one of love and of respect and dignity and not of shame. And so, Lord, thank you for taking our shame on yourself. And we just ask that you would draw us closer to you as we go through our day and through this week. And we just give today to you. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
This podcast and its content are designed and intended to provide a place for conversation. Topics and advice covered in this podcast should not be taken as professional medical advice or emotional or spiritual counsel. If you or a loved one needs professional help, they should seek a licensed professional. The views covered and discussed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of WCSG Radio or Cornerstone University. Ideas presented are not necessarily endorsed by WCSG Radio or Cornerstone University.